Studio 360.
There's exactly one old American hymn that everybody recognizes, and that moves people who have no feeling for the spiritual or religious, because it long ago transcended the church and became a folk song and an anthem for civil rights. But its origins are unexpected and complicated. For our latest American Icon segment, Trey Kay has the story of Amazing Grace.
In 1748, a slave ship was heading back to England from Charleston, South Carolina, after having discharged its cargo of African natives. They were getting closer to home, just off the coast of Donegal, Ireland, when bam! The ship gets battered by a violent storm. The boards of the hull are popping off, and water is gushing into the hold. It seems certain that the boat is going to go down. The captain and the crew work frantically to patch the leak. The captain orders a man, named John Newton, onto the deck to steer the vessel.
And he has to strap himself to the helm to avoid, you know, sliding down the deck.
That's Steve Turner, author of Amazing Grace, the story of America's most beloved song.
And it's at that point that he becomes a Christian. He vows that if his life is saved, that he's going to pursue this relationship with God.
Miraculously, the ship survives the storm. Newton keeps his word and devotes the rest of his life to the Christian faith. Now, this is a famous story, and it's usually spun into some triumphant, I've seen the light moment. The story goes that Newton, who had worked in the slave trade for years, at that moment renounced slavery. But did Newton really have a conversion?
He didn't leave the slave trade immediately. In fact, he went back to Liverpool and became the captain of a ship for the first time. And he did three voyages as a captain of a slave ship.
Newton would captain slave ships for another 14 years. During this time, he was devout to his Christian practice, but he never saw his work in the slave trade as being at odds with his religion. After health problems drove him ashore for good, he eventually made his way into the Anglican clergy. Newton became the priest of a small chapel in the English town of Olney. Over time, he began to write hymns to accompany his sermons. On New Year's Day, 1773, he introduced his congregation to a hymn that was inspired in part by his near-death experience at sea. It's called Faith's Review and Expectation, but it's come to be known by its opening phrase.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
That's Deborah Carlton Loftus, executive director of the Hymn Society of the United States and Canada.
Well, it wouldn't have been to the tune that we all recognize as associated with Amazing Grace.
Newton didn't write the tune that we know. Actually, he didn't write any tunes for his hymns. He wrote his verses in a common meter that could be sung to many different melodies.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
It's often said that Amazing Grace was written by an abolitionist. But John Newton wasn't an abolitionist when he wrote it. He never spoke of slavery from the pulpit. And it wasn't until 1788, 15 years after he wrote the hymn, that Newton finally spoke out against slavery, publishing an anti-slavery pamphlet, and becoming, finally, an outspoken abolitionist. But at the time, having written Amazing Grace wasn't his claim to fame.
Was Amazing Grace a popular hymn in England at the time that John Newton wrote it?
Actually not. It was not very well known, not considered in England to be one of his finest hymns. But it came over to the United States and picked up some usage and popularity in the revival meetings of the Second Great Awakening.
The Second Great Awakening was a Protestant revival movement that began around 1790 and continued into the late 1850s. It started in western New York and moved down through the Ohio Valley into Kentucky and Tennessee. Folks would travel in covered wagons from far away to camp for a couple of weeks, worshiping with preachers from various denominations.
Thousands of people would come together for these outdoor revival meetings.
Singing was a big part of these meetings.
There were choruses and refrains that people could learn quickly.
At the time, America had several schools that had the purpose of training teachers to help church congregations engage in the beautiful harmonic singing of sacred words. Enthusiastic, even ecstatic singing was the hallmark of these large camp revival gatherings. Music scholars believe Amazing Grace was sung at these revivals to many different tunes.
So far, 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 so.
William Walker was a singing teacher in South Carolina who published a songbook called Southern Harmony in 1847. That's the first documented instance when Newton's words were set to a tune called New Britain. Deborah Loftus says that back in the heyday of the revival meetings, it wasn't only whites attending.
We have documented that both free black persons and white people were together for these outdoor revivals, and there was a lot of interchange of musical styles.
These singing styles were passed on through the generations in African-American families. We're hearing the singing of a family who are descendants of slaves that were featured in the 1990 Bill Moyers documentary about Amazing Grace.
I think the song would have had a great attraction for the African slaves that were in chattel slavery, in bondage, in cruel, horrific oppression.
That's Reverend Matthew J. Watts, pastor of the Grace Bible Church in Charleston, West Virginia.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining.
Pastor Watts is singing a verse that today is often included in performances of Amazing Grace, but it's not something that was written by John Newton. That's because camp revival music leaders tended to do a bit of mashing up of hymns, singing them to different tunes, lifting verses from one hymn and singing them in another. That's what happened with Amazing Grace. In 1852, some of the verses written by Newton, along with the When We've Been There 10,000 Years verse, appeared in the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tom sings these Amazing Grace verses in his darkest hour. Author Harriet Beecher Stowe was the daughter and sister of revival preachers, and she may have heard Amazing Grace sung this way at a revival meeting. Some think her novel may have played a role in shaping how we sing Amazing Grace today.
So it's a moment of fusion between traditional, you might say, high society, white culture, and popular culture, black culture, revival, evangelical culture.
Jim Basker teaches English and history at Barnard College, and he's the editor of Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery. He says Stowe had met with runaway slaves, and she read slave narratives, and that she knew the song would resonate with African Americans.
So when she reached into that scene, and this is a moment of fusion between whites and blacks, it's a white woman author creating one of the most memorable black characters in all of 19th century literature. She reached for what would be the paradigmatic song from his soul that he might sing on his deathbed, and it's Amazing Grace.
The first recording of Amazing Grace was in 1922 by a group known as the Original Sacred Harp Choir. Around this time, the hymn was adopted as a folk song, and musicologist John Lomax and his son Alan were famous for capturing authentic folk performances, like this 1935 recording of Kentucky folk singer Aunt Molly Jackson. In the 1920s and 30s, there were the beginnings of a recording industry catering to the demand for songs appealing to a religious black audience. That's Reverend J.M. Gates' recording of Amazing Grace, which sold thousands of copies. And throughout the century, all of the great gospel singers would record the song, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. During the Civil Rights era, activist Fannie Lou Hamer would lead protesters to sing songs like Amazing Grace, helping to define racial equality as a moral and religious pursuit. By the 1960s, white folk singers were finding their way to Amazing Grace, like Arlo Guthrie, who sang the song at Woodstock.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
But Guthrie's version was not nearly as popular as one by another white artist who would soon follow.
My name is Judy Collins.
In 1969, Judy Collins was attending what she calls an encounter group, when things got really contentious. Collins' record producer happened to be there.
And he said, you know, people are really at each other's throats. Isn't there anything you could do to settle them down? Why don't you sing something? And my grandmother was a church-going Methodist, and she had taught me Amazing Grace when I was a little girl. So I sang Amazing Grace. It was one of the few songs that I knew that I figured everybody would know something of, and they all sang, and it did settle everybody down.
The next day, that same producer called and said, we have to record that song.
So I said, well, let's go into a church somewhere. And so we went up to the campus of Columbia University, and we went into the chapel. It's called St. Paul's. It's a gorgeous chapel, and we all got together and we recorded Amazing Grace.
"'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear."
Elektra Records released Collins' recording of Amazing Grace on her 1970 Wales and Nightingales album.
My record company was flabbergasted. They didn't know what hit him.
The album went gold, and her recording of John Newton's hymn became a top 40 hit. And then it seemed like everybody, black or white, rock or blues or country, wanted to put their own signature on the song. Judy Collins' recording of Amazing Grace was also a hit on British radio, which means that two centuries after Newton had penned it in England,
where it never really caught on, it was finally finding an audience. This caught the ear of a bagpiper from the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, who was inspired to give Collins' arrangement a Highlander feel. The Dragoon Guards' recording of Amazing Grace also became a major hit in England, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa. Collins liked hearing her arrangement on the bagpipes.
And I am thrilled that it has now permeated the police and firefighters.
For centuries, bagpipes have been an important part of Celtic funeral traditions. But the Dragoon Guards' recording sparked the tradition of piping Amazing Grace at memorials for police, firefighters, and military. It's certainly a tradition New Yorkers know well, after the attacks on September 11th, 2001.
I can hear it. You know, I live on the Upper West Side, and about a block from me is the Firefighters Memorial on Riverside Drive. And so every once in a while, we hear the bagpipes coming up from the river, and we hear them playing Amazing Grace. And we see like 5,000 firefighters out there in the street with their uniforms. It's an amazing thing. It's very moving. And it's, of course, the appropriate place for this song to go. I mean, it belongs in these situations because it is regenerating the idea of hope and forgiveness.
Amazing grace, how sweet.
And after a mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, President Barack Obama offered the song's message of hope and forgiveness to the mourners.
A wretch like me.
Author Steve Turner.
You know, Obama sings it at the church in Charleston after the murders, and you know, it's sung when policemen have funerals in New York. It just seems kind of like an all-purpose, hopeful song.
Barnard College professor James Basker says the song, both the musical notes and its lyrics, appeal to people at moments of intense suffering.
And they appeal without any narrowness. There's no specific condition, there's no specific religious faith, there's no specific cultural context. It's just about that thing that human beings share, which is pain. And the imaginative yearning, and this is the thing about human beings, we're able to imagine and to yearn for joy and peace, for relief from the miseries of this world. So it's the use of the human imagination, both the creative one that made the song and the receptive, interactive one that can identify with it, that lifts us up.
Amazing grace.
Throughout its history, Amazing Grace has spoken to Americans' belief in new beginnings and reinvention.
That's a very important part of the American mentality, you know, that you can start again, that you can come from nothing and succeed, and you can overcome a bad or dubious or hampering past. So all those things are in the song.
I want her.
You can feel as though you are lost. And somehow know that you'll be found.
But now
I'm found. What you say, girl?
But now
I'm found. They still can't feel you.
But now
I'm found.
Was blind,
but now
I see.
That piece was produced by Trey Kay, who also hosts a podcast called Us and Them. By the way, Judy Collins' recording of Amazing Grace was just selected to be a part of the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. You can hear any of our dozens of American icons at studio360.org. Listen to them all, and you'll earn a degree in American Studies from Studio 360 University.